All right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the inaugural broadcast of the Zoloff Cervano Show on WWDB Talk 860. My name is Joe Dougherty. We've got a fantastic show. I want to welcome John Cervano into the program. How are you, John?
Good afternoon, Joe.
It's great to be here. Certainly, Jeff Fritz, how are you, sir?
Hey, Joe. Happy 2022.
That's right. It's our also our first broadcast in 2022. Certainly been looking forward to this particular show. And our inaugural guest, we saved the best for first, and so ecstatic to bring into the program Renee Williams, who's the executive director of the National Center for Victims of Crime. Renee, how are you?
Hi, Joe. I'm great. Thanks for having me.
It's our pleasure. I want to start off by first. We'll talk to John for a second as our co-host. About what you expect with the program, what you hope to accomplish, you know, as we launch and as we move forward in regards to educating listeners on the law and the different issues.
I think you nailed the how do you say that?
Hit the nail on the head.
Yeah, we're here to try to educate our listeners on the issues that we talk about, particularly with respect to the issue we're going to talk about today, crime victims and sexual assault cases. In the past, we've touched on medical malpractice issues and other areas of the law, and I'm hoping that this program will enlighten folks so that if they do have a problem, they can recognize what the problem is and they can seek help for it.
Absolutely. And Jeff Fritz, how are you, sir?
We're good here.
Well, I want to thank you for getting us live and making this all happen. This is your area of expertise. Obviously, in regards to the law and the civil aspect of criminal victims, victims of crime. Talk about, you know, your passion for justice in that area.
Yeah. So, I mean, what I try to do, I've been practicing 25 years, 23 of which is representing crime victims. And it's really, you know, while people sometimes look at it as, well, you're their civil lawyer. No, it's not that simple. It's helping them in any way that they need help. And that can be in the criminal justice system or the civil justice system and just different avenues to get help and to get benefits to help innocent crime victims to rebuild their lives. And, you know, interestingly, and I didn't intend this to be a segue, but Renee has a podcast that she does called Parallel Justice. Is that correct, Renee?
That is correct.
And that's really the way I view my role and our role as advocates for victims is how can we help get them achieve parallel justice in the criminal system and the justice system.
And let's bring Renee into the broadcast. First of all, obviously, we appreciate you being with us. And certainly, this is a fascinating discussion. We're going to talk about parallel justice as we go on in the program. But if you would first, Renee, introduce yourself to our listeners. Tell everybody a little bit about yourself and your pathway to where you are.
Absolutely. Well, I am Renee Williams. I am the executive director, as you said, of the National Center for Victims of Crime, which is a nonprofit based in the Washington, D.C. area. My pathway to where I am has been a twisted road. I like to tell people that I was smartly spontaneous. I began as a theater major, but had some background in volunteering in criminal justice associations within high school, and a theater major led to a law degree, which led to having a real passion for helping both victims of crime and indigent clients, which is how I ended up at the National Center.
Yeah, and certainly, you know, the organization is fascinating. If you would tell our listeners, what exactly is the National Center for Victims of Crime?
So you have to understand that we have a history, and I think the history is just as fascinating as what we do now. We really began out of a family's pain and suffering. Alla and Alex Van Alsberg, their mother was Sunny Von Bulow, and the case of Sunny Von Bulow was really one of the first true true crime cases in the United States. A lot of people will remember it. It's when we first heard the name Alan Dershowitz come up, and we really got a sense of true crime and what wealth and power can achieve within the justice system. So Alla and Alex's mother, Sunny, was the victim of an attempted homicide, and she then went into a coma, and her husband at the time was believed to have committed that crime by injecting her with insulin. Sunny lived in a coma throughout the rest of her days, but Alla and Alex were just so impacted by how they were treated throughout the court system. And they realized that they were wealthy and they were powerful. And if they were having that experience, they couldn't imagine what other crime victims went through. And they wanted to make sure that no other families went through that, because at the time, that was really before the victims' rights movement. So they started our center, and we've been around for 35 years now. We really spearheaded most of the victims' rights movement, and we did a lot of advocacy at the time. We pushed through a lot of the laws that are bedrocks in our society now. We've pivoted a little bit as we've had so many victories and made so much progress. We realized that there are still needs. So we now have 5 different centers. We have a center for victim service professionals, where we go out and we train police officers, we train attorneys, we teach people best practices, how to help victims, and what trends they should be looking for. We have a center for research and innovation, where we gather all this data on crimes, because we help all victims of crimes. And then we synthesize that so that we can explain to the powerful people and the people making policy, we can tell them what they need to be looking at next. We have the Center for Victim and Survivor Services that provides direct support to victims of crime through our hotlines. And we also have a hotline consortium where we've gathered all the top hotlines in the United States, and we share best practices with them. We have a special tribal center, which is the victim assistance and services to tribes. And then we have a part of our group that is very near and dear to Jeff's heart, which is the National Crime Victim Bar Association. And that is a group of attorneys throughout the United States who have dedicated their practices to representing victims of crime in the civil justice system. And I'm sure we're going to get into this, so I'm going to stop now, but there are some crucial differences we need to talk about between the criminal and civil justice system.
Jeff, you want to jump in there?
So, yeah, no. Well, first, Renee, yes, attorneys. I like to call them angels, because it's and how many do we have across the country now? Like
About 400.
Yeah, 400. This all started with like 5 attorneys over 22, 23 years ago, just getting together and saying, all right, what can we do to help victims? How can we support each other and work with each other and share ideas and thoughts? And so that's what we did, but we've since grown it, and now there's like 400 members across the country. We hold annual, you know, educational thing, training, seminars, conferences, and then we also do an outreach to victim service providers across the country, which are folks that work every day with victims, and tell them about what civil justice can add to help rebuild a victim's life.
It from a layman, you know, it almost seems, and we, you know, we've all seen these stories where somebody was the victim of a crime, and then they become, in many cases, or at least, and I'm sure it still happens today, victimized again by the system when you go to report the crime, at the point of reporting the crime. Would that be an area, Renee and Jeff, where the organization is trying to, you know, create programs, you know, in a lot of different areas, but one might be sensitivity training and how to address a situation? Because although you may know the law and you may be a law enforcement issue, I mean, officer or professional, that does not mean that you, in a lot of ways, John Zervanos, as an attorney, you know, you may be a great attorney, but having that bedside manner to be able to take somebody who's been, you know, and I saw some of the podcasts, Renee, a victim, you know, somebody who was molested by a priest in the Catholic Church, which I'm a Catholic, so I don't have any problem bringing that up. You know, it still infuriates me on a daily basis when I hear those stories. But John, we've talked about it many times, being a great attorney. Also, you have to have that bedside manner. Sounds like kind of the same thing that they're trying to do to train law enforcement when somebody is the victim of a crime.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, if you have a good bedside manner, you're going to establish trust between you and your client, and that is so important. If you have the trust of your client, you're going to be able to make something happen, and that something is usually a good result because they'll listen to you.
And Renee, when same exact thing. Obviously, what I'm saying, there's a parallel there. When somebody goes to report something, especially when we're talking about the types of crimes that we're talking about, a lot of these, sexual assaults and all those things. I saw the podcast, Renee. I think it was, I'll actually look at my notes, but you did a, how one attorney took on the Catholic Church and dealing with that type of situation. A person who might be 40 years old or 35 years old who has to report that, okay, somebody's got, there has to be education. I'm assuming that's a big part of what you guys do.
Absolutely. And I think that's a hugely important thing to bring up. And as Jeff said, they're angels. I shy away from saying plaintiff's attorneys because people get a certain idea in their head. And that's not what our attorneys are. And when they're fighting through the civil justice system, a lot of times it's to make change. So what people don't understand is institutions like the Catholic Church, like Boy Scouts of America, like the Olympics committees, they don't have criminal liability most of the time. There is no way to hold them accountable unless you're going for them to make policy changes or you're going after their money. And that's what seems to really make them wake up and get their attention. Because otherwise, there's almost never criminal liability. So you can go through the criminal justice system to get your individual perpetrator. And sometimes that can be even more traumatic, because I think what the general public doesn't realize is that prosecutors are not their attorneys. They do not represent the victims. They are doing hard work. They work hard. They are doing God's work.
Right.
They're there to represent the state. And that is what it is. They're there to do a job. And a lot of them are victim-centered, but their job is not always to protect the victim themselves. So they're not necessarily worried about going after the Catholic Church. They're not worried about going against the big institutions. And if that was the way we proceeded all the time, then these institutions would not have any impetus for change. They'd have no reason to make
changes. Have nothing to lose.
And correct.
Change happens in the courtroom. Okay. And not just, especially at institutions that are allowing individuals, putting them in a position to do something and then go get transferred to another a part of the country. If there are no consequences of one, one way or the other. Talk about that, Jeff.
But Joe, you said change happens in the courtroom, and right. I want to make a distinction here.
Sure.
Most cases don't end up in a courtroom, and I know, one of the first things I'm often asked by anybody I represent, but certainly survivors of violent crime, is, hey, is my case going to go to trial? Because I don't know if I can do that. Well, sometimes yes, sometimes no. We have to be prepared either way. But so I don't think it's just change comes in the courtroom. Change comes through litigation and holding people and corporations and institutions accountable. And that's what we're about.
And at that point, oh, go ahead. I'm sorry, Renee.
And I was going to say, to build on what Jeff said, not just through litigation, because not in through the courtroom, but a congressional inquiry can make an institution sit up a little straighter and make sure everything's buttoned up. So with the Olympics committee, they did go through court. But before that, there was a congressional inquiry. And that tends to get attention, too. And those types of results usually are through attorneys who have a passion and who just doggedly stay on a case to make sure the right thing is done.
Talk about the not the advocacy, but the some of the actions that you've taken that have brought about change, and maybe in the eyes of Congress, maybe legislatively. Does the organization fight on a legislative level for change, or mostly advocacy, but still in an effective manner?
Most of our advocacy is done through the Victims Bar Association as a 501c3, and because of a lot of our federal grantees, we're actually not allowed to lobby. I'm not allowed to in any way try to influence legislation. However, I am a policy nerd, and so I can talk to a congressman until I'm blue in the face about what the long-term policy ramifications of certain actions they may take are, and that's permissible as long as I'm not doing it within the context of a law. That's very different from where we started. So we started by pushing through a lot of the Crime Victims' Rights Acts. Those started from us.
I have some examples.
Sure.
What about the extension of the statute of limitations that has occurred in states, particularly in New York, where they've opened the window so victims of crime and sexual assault can now resurrect a case that might have been extinguished way back in the day, and now it's a viable case. And Jeff knows way more about that issue than me.
Yeah, that is a good example. Renee, off the top of your head, I don't have this answer, but how many states have we have statutes of limitation been opened up in window-wise? Do you know?
That would take a very quick search for me because we're doing work in it, but off the top of my head, I could not give you an exact number.
Yeah, I'd say it's about a third of the states in the country now. Within this area, New Jersey, New York. Now, Pennsylvania, we got really close. There was sort of an administrative error in Pennsylvania, which actually led to the Secretary of State in Pennsylvania having to resign, and we're hopefully in 2022 back on track to get statutes of limitation open for victims of child sexual abuse. And I think this is the year to do it.
Talk about creating awareness, because although you may not be able to lobby as a nonprofit, obviously, creating awareness and utilizing the resources and the individuals in the organization, like Jeff Ritz and John Zervanos, individuals who are passionate about representing victims' rights. And I never thought about the prosecutors. You know, their job is not victims' rights. They're there to get justice. Don't get me wrong, and to prosecute. But talk about what the organization has done to create awareness for these issues, because I'm sure for years and decades people were overlooked in regards to not just their rights, but the way they were treated when a woman reported a rape or had any voice at all.
What you're talking about is how much of the individuals within who work with victims and help victims are trauma informed.
Right.
And I know the National Center has training, education, outreach in that regard. Renee?
Yes. And it's not even necessarily being trauma informed, it's knowing what laws are in place. So every state has some type of Crime Victims' Rights Act, whether it's a Marcy's Law, whether it's called something else. Every single state has one. The problem is that when you get into some of these smaller jurisdictions, they don't necessarily know, and they don't necessarily have the time to look it up. So the victims' rights aren't always protected, even though by paper they should be. And that's a large part of what we do, is we try to train folks as to what is available in their state. For the Bar Association itself, we travel from state to state. We're booking 4 conferences this year where we'll be teaching people, victim advocates specifically, and it's a free training, and we teach them what rights are available civilly. We also have a huge conference every year called the National Training Institute, where we just try to train people on what rights are out there, what best practices are, and what they can do to better help their victims.
Yeah, victims' rights, it sounds like a term, a legal term, but in a sense, though, explain and give us an idea of what victims' rights mean, because you're right. We always focus on prosecuting and going after the individual who committed the crime. What are victims' rights?
So in our justice system, we focus on the defendant's rights, and that is completely constitutionally appropriate. And that is the way we want things to be, because if any one of us was accused of a crime, we would want those constitutional protections in place.
Sure.
I'm not here to make an argument about that.
Right.
But we have done that, and we've pushed aside victims. So there are some very basic things that victims' rights are, like the right to be present at every hearing. Sometimes in certain criminal cases, victims are only considered witnesses, so they can't come to certain hearings. The right to have notice of every hearing, the right to know if your perpetrator has been released. And these actually, and let me say this right now, there's a false tension between victims' rights advocates and criminal justice reform advocates. And at the National Center, we actually do both. We also have a very strong criminal justice reform arm where we're encouraging it because we don't think that those two groups have quite the differences that we think.
John Savanos, talk about how the organization works well with the firm, and you know how you utilize these types of advocacy opportunities for somebody who is a victim. In combination for representing them in their case.
Well, it's a resource. So you can
if I call it the resource.
Yeah, go ahead, Jeff. Why don't you answer that question?
Yeah, no. So it's really this network that's been built, and where attorney, like I might have a case against a given religious organization or corporation, and I know that I can turn to my brothers and sisters around the country who might have already dealt with that organization before, and they can share some information that way. So, you know, if it's from that, or it's just finding the right experts to work with that might be knowledgeable and helpful for us. And I've been relying upon the National Center for Victims of Crime and the Bar Association for two decades now. And Renee, again, let me officially thank you. Thank you for all the work that you do and the National Center does.
I think one of the things the public would appreciate is that plaintiff's lawyers, and we're not supposed to use the term plaintiff's lawyers today, but lawyers that represent victims of crime, victims of personal injury, you name it, we finally have our act together and joined forces by, we have had organizations that have existed for a long time, but we've created these opportunities for lawyers who are members of these organizations to exchange ideas and trade their experiences against a particular defendant. And like Jeff said, one of the things that is really invaluable is learning about the defendant and how they might try to defend the case, or learning about particular experts that are well versed in this area. And having that resource makes all the difference, because when you're taking on a powerful institution, we've used the Catholic Church for example, they clearly are a very powerful institution, and if you're going to take them head on, you better have the resources and the network that can level the playing field. And that's what organizations like this do for us, and that translates to better representation for our clients.
To the individuals that utilize the organization's resources, are they mostly attorneys?
So, I mean, there's, as Renee mentioned, there's two or multiple sides to this, but one arm of it is the National Crime Victim Bar Association. Those are attorneys and professionals such as experts and things like that who are versed in working with victims in that way. But that's not the end of the resources, and there's other resources either for, like Renee mentioned, she's a policy nerd. And, you know, just finding out about what's available out there to help to make every place safer. That's the number one goal, but also that we might be able to utilize in talking to legislators and getting the laws changed to help victims.
Okay, so when it comes to, you know, obviously the organization itself, you know, it's not a lot, obviously it's a nonprofit, not a lobbying organization, but as an attorney and somebody who cares about these issues, the things that you learn and you understand are on the table, you're able to go out to a not on behalf of the organization, but maybe the trial lawyers, or on behalf of the firm, to kind of impact legislation that would help victims' rights.
Or even taking it a step further is assisting victims, because, you know, it's empowering for some victims and part of their recovery process. You know, I heard this line the other day. I wish I remember who said it, but recovery can't happen until accountability occurs first. And so that's the idea. In one way, there are victims whom I've had the ability to represent that they want to go out and say, hey, look, it's not just about me, it's about this bigger issue. What can I do to help change the law to help people in the future? And so it's about helping them get their message out and their attempt to lobby, convince, you know, speak to their legislators, because that's what this whole country's about.
Sure. Outreach. How often do crime victims themselves utilize the resources, and how do they find out about them? Is it through their attorneys, or the does the organization do outreach? And because these are it seems like invaluable resources.
So again, we have the hotline, which is Victim Connect.
Right.
And Victim Connect has its own website, and you can link to it from any of NCVC's websites. And that's our hotline. There's a chat line. Any way you can think of to get a hold of us, we're available. So we do a lot of outreach that way. And that's, people don't seem to have trouble getting a hold of us. A lot of that is within our training, is us pushing out to victim advocates the fact that we exist. We also do have an attorney referral service through the Bar Association. And the way we get the word out about that is by traveling and presenting to victim advocates what civil justice is. But if victims have experienced victimization and they are looking for an attorney, they can come on our website and request an attorney.
What is the website, Renee?
Victimbar.org.
Yeah, I mean, the resources are really fantastic, and I'm looking. When I look at the, you have the confidential hotline, and educating individuals and talking about a victim, you know, somebody who's gone through. John, as a firm that represents individuals that have been just, you know, in horrible situations, I'm assuming, you know, the firm culture is it's about not only representing them, but also treating them and understanding, educating them on their rights, and passing on, you know, the victims, not just a legal situation. Is that kind of embedded in the firm's culture?
It's funny that you said firm culture. We had a situation recently within the firm where I was reinforcing the firm culture to someone in the office, another young attorney, and my message to that lawyer was, what is more empowering than waking up in the morning and being excited to go to work? And the reason why you're excited to go to work is because you got, metaphorically, you got the sword in hand, and you're taking on Goliath, and you're just standing up for the little guy, and they, you know, that's kind of the firm culture. It's like, fight for the little guy, fight for the powerless, you know, and in doing that, there's some professional satisfaction in that, but you're helping people and seeing the results of that. You can't ask for anything better as a professional.
You know, I find me, I'm thinking about this, and I keep going back to what Renee said in regards to the disposition and responsibility of a prosecutor as compared. The attorneys in the organization, are they mostly civil attorneys? I say that because prosecutors who deal with crimes represent the government. They represent the state often, and their job is to prosecute, not represent. What types of attorneys are in the organization?
They are all civil attorneys now, but there were many, many, many past prosecutors.
Yeah, I mean, and so, you know, certainly, as Jeff, as a civil attorney, and you're dealing with individuals on a, first-hand basis, you're representing them legally and their case and all those things, but do you take on a responsibility also, obviously being a member of the organization, to also educate them on all the resources that are available to them, in their case, along with the legal representation?
Yeah, sure. And actually, the former director of the National Crime Victim Bar Association imparted this to me years ago, and I never thought about it this way. There is no victim that calls you, takes the time to put some faith in you and reaches out to you, put some trust to reach out to you. There's no victim you can't help who calls you. There's some mechanism, there's some remedy, there's some resource that's available to help them. My job is to figure out which are the ones that are going to help them or not help them. And that's what the National Center does to help us, is identify this.
You know, what I find interesting as you say that is that, let's just say, like, John, you talked about the statute of limitations that have been extended. That, thank God, that has happened for people that hopefully can get some kind of a justice for something that they happened when they were a child. But in some cases, you may not be able to provide that justice. Maybe a statute of limitation, but you can always provide these resources that.
And it might be crime victim mm-hmm. compensation through the state. It might be helping them through the criminal justice system where they can get restitution. And it might be simply, there is not a remedy available here for you, but at least you're able to answer that question and put that idea to, you know, so that they're informed.
Are there resources for victims of crime, even if let's just say maybe they settled their case or maybe they don't have a case because of the statute of limitation. Are there resources, Renee, that you can or direction you can put somebody who's gone through emotional trauma, who's been a victim of something, especially the cases that really the horrid stories when you hear about victims of sexual assault?
He's talking about counseling kind
yes.
of resources?
Yes.
And that's most of the cases that come in. Frankly, most of the cases that come our way, there is not going to be a civil case that's possible. And it's for the reasons you named, such as statutes of limitations. But sometimes, and Jeff and John can both talk to this, you have to have the very hard conversation with a victim of, you have a case, your statute hasn't run, but it's against an individual. And a lot of times this, unfortunately, is in the incest familial cases.
Yeah.
Even if you sue, you're not going to get anything. You are going to get a piece of paper. And at the end of the day, you are going to go through a whole lot more trauma in being in court and having to testify and having to face a defense attorney in deposition. You're going to incur a lot, many more costs. And at the end of the day, the piece of paper is just not worth it. But I have found that very good attorneys, when they can walk a victim through that, the victim usually walks away still happier, even though they couldn't file the case. So sometimes just being heard and just having somebody listen to them and say, I believe you, there's nothing I can do, but I believe you, makes all the difference in the world.
I find that it's fascinating, but also the fact you mentioned that a crime victim is not always somebody that has a civil case, and when you're dealing with somebody who's going through those types of situations, John, if you know, you mentioned a young lawyer, right? And we're not picking on any one particular lawyer, but I'm just saying, when you know, and Jeff, when you know that there's somebody coming.
I'm not the young lawyer.
unfortunately, you know. But having said that, hypothetically, if you know an individual has come in, and maybe it's been difficult to have that conversation. How do you handle that from a firm standpoint? Let's just say it didn't come through Jeff, who's very experienced at this, and that young lawyer may get the call. How do you prepare as a firm for somebody to come in and have that conversation? Maybe, you know, you educate the young lawyer on how to handle, at least from a disposition, whether it's a case, maybe that young attorney is a crackerjack, you know, in regards to knowing the law.
I think you got to educate them first. They got to know what they're talking about when they're talking.
But in sensitivity training.
Yeah, but sensitivity training is kind of a feel, and you get that's like an it's a little bit of a sensitive training. You don't just wake up and you're sensitive. And I have been guilty of that time and time again, because if you're trying to explain to a client what the right thing to do is, and you're doing it as best you can, and that client is resistant, you know, as you know, you get frustrated sometimes, and it takes everything you have to be patient and calm. Because if you're patient and calm and try to walk them through it, they'll eventually come around. And I can think of an example, you know, 3-4 years ago where I got so frustrated, you know, the worst of me got the best of me, and I got angry, and I lost, and I didn't lose the client. I mean, we eventually settled it, but, you know, he left with a bad taste in his mouth. And that takes a lot of work to be sensitive, and particularly when it comes to victims of crime. You're not going to ever really appreciate what it feels like to be a victim of crime, no matter how hard you try.
That's a really important point, is I've been doing this a long time, John's been doing this a long time, but I think it's incumbent and important for us to explain that we know that we don't know what it's like to be in their shoes, but we're going to help nonetheless anyway. And that's important for somebody to hear.
Yeah.
Right. Renee, what inspires you every day, and what inspired you to get to be where you are? Because you're not going after a civil action. There's no, you know, at the end of the day, as much as you want to provide relief to somebody, you know, it can be a long road. And Jeff, what you just said is, look, people are, even if you've been violated a little bit, even if, you know, if somebody did something that's not even that major, it could be something that sticks with you for the rest of your entire life. What inspired you, and what inspires you every day, Renee?
So what inspired me to go into any nonprofits? We're going way off track, but I had a liver transplant when I was 14 months old, and there's definitely a sense of obligation there. An infant died, and I am living for two of us, and it is my job on this earth to do everything I can to make an impact. Right, that's Renee, what I'm here to do.
Renee, I have to interject. My daughter had a liver transplant, and I was a living donor. And she is.
Oh my gosh, when?
Yeah, 1995, when she was 3 years old. She's going to be turning 30 this year.
Wow.
And
oh my gosh.
Back in the day, living related transplants were experimental. And I was the fifth one in the Delaware Valley to do it. And, you know, Jeff was here.
Not a greater gift.
Yeah.
That's incredible.
No.
It was.
And I was in 85, and they weren't doing living donors then, because it was still experimental in 95. So, you know, I grew up with the understanding that another infant had died for me to live. And so there's certainly a sense of obligation to give back. I'm also Christian, which I don't talk about often at work, but there's, to whom much has been given, much will be expected. So that's kind of what wakes me up in the morning and shoves me out of bed. But there's also a history of domestic violence within my extended family. And I saw the impact that that had on my cousins and on the rest of my family. And if this is where my talents are, that's what I need to do. That's taken some turns. There have been experiences post that with different victims, with different individuals who have told me different things along the way that have kept me going, or made me shift direction in some ways. But in general, that's what pushes me every day.
I mean, it blows me away when I hear that, being inspired by different events that fuel your passion and for a lifetime. Jeff, what you've been doing this area of law for a long time. I sometimes, when we do shows, I like to do something called case watch. And what that is, from my standpoint, is a case that may have impacted somebody to the point where it inspired the direction of where they're going. Every lawyer picks their own path at one point, and it's not always the first thing they do. But what you've been doing this for a long time and successfully, By the way, you were a great musician. You know, you could have very well went in another direction.
Well, it didn't go in that direction. Thank God, maybe. I don't know.
But right? For the grace of God, right?
Yeah. Well, since we're all getting personal, I'll lay it out here. So my mother died and was a victim of malpractice in 1979. I was 12 years old. In 1979, lawyers weren't readily available on TV, and my family was largely uneducated and thought they couldn't afford a lawyer to go after this medical institution, which led to her death. And I don't want to say that was like a direct, you know, reason why I went into this, but it certainly influenced things for me. And ironically or coincidentally, my mother once said to me, I was such a pain in the bleep as a kid. She goes, you know, you should be a lawyer. So that's part of it. But then, no, seriously, so then I started representing victims of just general personal injury negligence cases in the beginning of my practice. Then early on, I had my first case where I represented a victim, and that it was such a different experience for me that it really changed the course for me, because I realized that, and Renee and John, you know, tell me if you agree with this observation, but you get treated differently either as a lawyer or as a victim in the civil justice system, and it's not the same as if it's somebody who was just in a car accident or whatever. Not to downplay any of that, but seriously, courts, judges, and the system will sometimes give you the benefit of the doubt because they know that you were an innocent victim of this crime.
So we're going to take 5 minutes. We'll take a little break. And it's a fascinating conversation we're having. We'll have more from Saul from Zorana's show after the break.
To battle is to fight, to struggle, to overcome. And ultimately for the Marine Corps, it means to win. There is no alternative. It's not just a statement of intent. It's a promise to our nation. A promise kept for more than two centuries. A promise of the Marines.
On the battlefield, there's a saying America's military men and women live by. Never leave a fallen warrior behind, ever. Off the battlefield, Wounded Warrior Project operates with the same goal. Wounded Warrior Project was created to help our men and women returning home with the scars of war, whether those scars are physical or mental. Wounded Warrior Project. We never leave a fallen warrior behind. Ever. Learn more about what we do at woundedwarriorproject.org.
When a child is diagnosed with cancer, the last thing parents should have to worry about is how to pay for it. This is a St. Jude moment.
Calvin got diagnosed June 10th of 2018. He has rhabdomyosarcoma, a soft tissue cancer. One oncologist told us if it was my son, we'd go to St. Jude. And within 24 hours, we were on a plane headed here. It's hard to fathom what St. Jude has done for us. They've really given our family hope. For the donors out there, it's just amazing. I never thought we would be in this place. And it's people like you that help us and help St. Jude provide for a family like ours. St. Jude is like the gold at the end of a rainbow. And we are so grateful and thankful for everything.
Finding cures, saving children. Learn more at stjude.org.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the Saul Hoffman Serrano Show. We've got a fantastic show. Lots to talk about. And our guest on the broadcast is Renee Williams, Executive Director of the National Center for Victims of Crime. And certainly Jeff Fritz and John Zervanos here from the firm. one of the things we were talking about during the break is an interesting comment that which threw me off because it's almost like a play on words. You always sit there and you assume that everybody's got the right to an attorney. Of course, if you're if you're accused of a crime, you can always sit. You see, we all see it on TV. I want to talk to an attorney, but a victim doesn't necessarily, that's not always in their ballpark. Elaborate on that, Renee, if you will.
Sure. So I think we think in our society, I have a right to an attorney. And that is something that comes out of a lot of people's mouths, especially when they contact us. What people don't understand is, unfortunately, you do have a right to have an attorney present with you in the court hearing at all times. However, that's if you can afford that attorney. You don't have the right for the government to pay for your attorney, whether or not you're a victim. The only folks that get the government to pay for their attorney are criminal defendants. And that goes back to, you get a prosecutor on the case, there will be a prosecutor, but they don't necessarily represent your interests. So if you can afford an attorney, or if you can find an attorney that's willing to sit with you, you have a right to have them present, but you don't have a right for somebody else to pay for one.
Jeff, talk about that.
Yeah, well, that actually leads to the idea here, which is, I would say, and correct me if I'm wrong, Renee, but I'd say a majority of the attorneys who are members of the National Crime Victim Bar Association view their obligation and will fulfill the obligation to represent that victim in the criminal justice system. Because as you mentioned, Renee just mentioned, that prosecutor is not representing the victim. You're a witness in that process, you're a victim in that process, but they don't represent you. So there can be times, and often there are times, when that victim needs representation to assert their rights, some of the rights we talked about, the right to be heard, to be timely advised of court appearances. Well, how about this one? Here's a simple right that gets overlooked: to be treated with dignity and respect. Most states in the United States have that written into their laws. Some states, like New Jersey, they have it written into the Constitution. A victim has a right to be treated with dignity and respect. Well, who's going to fight for that right in the criminal case? The victim has to fight for himself or herself, or have an attorney who's going to do that, and that's what we try to do.
That's it. Have you ever? And that is a really interesting part of being a civil attorney. I've never thought of that. That part of it. Nobody walks. Yes, you may have a DA call, and give you an update on a case. Okay, and be sensitive, if possible, in that while they're going through the actual investigation part. But as a civil attorney, you have that opportunity if you're brought in early enough during that process. How often does that actually happen, Jeff?
It happens more than you would think. I mean, recently, and unfortunately, and I'm sure Renee can attest to this, the first hurdle sometimes is I'll show up in court, or these days in Zoom court, right? And the judge or the prosecutor will say to me, well, why are you here? I have the prosecutor. I have the criminal defense attorney. Who are you? Why are you here? Why do you have a right to be on this, in this hearing or this call or whatever? And I have to educate that court or the prosecutor or anybody in the room is, no, that victim has a right to representation. So it does happen. And we, look, we try to work with the prosecutor as much as possible, but there can be times when their goals are different than what the victim's goals are. So as another example, victims have a right in most states to be told about plea agreements. Is the state going to cut a plea deal with that criminal defendant? Well, they have a right only to be told about it, and for the state or the DA prosecutor to listen to what the victim's perspective and wants and needs are. Doesn't mean they're going to follow it.
Do you, John? Oh, okay. Having said that, have you gotten in the middle of liaisoning, working on with a client at that level, where they're, you're representing their civil, situation, but at the same time, you're actually liaisoning what's going on with the criminal case?
Sometimes you have to, yes.
Amazing. You know, it's something that you would just take for granted. You would think it would be, but then you realize that, you know, that if they don't have that, if they, it's their rights there, and people aren't, I'm sure, explaining to victims all the time through a process what exactly what's going on as it relates to their.
I can add one thing.
Sure.
A lot of times the prosecutors don't want to share the contents of their investigation, or the police don't want to share the contents of their investigation because they think you're going to somehow
undermine their.
Are they required? The question is, are they required to?
No, they're not. And
they look at you as a nuisance to their case?
Sometimes they do. Some detectives are very, very willing to share information.
And that's where the organization comes through, victims' rights, because I find it absolutely incredible that, in a sense, if you really look at it, the victims' rights are not always represented when they get when they're the victim of a crime.
Victims are the moral core of our justice system, but they get shuffled to the side so often in protection of the defendant's rights, which, again, is constitutionally appropriate. But I don't think that it has to be that big of a sacrifice to victims.
Do you ever get, Renee, does the organization ever get calls and inquiries from victims where, and I see you have an attorney referral program where you actually can connect a victim to, and obviously the attorneys that are in this office right now, who will help them along those lines?
We talked about two different resources we have. We have the attorney referral service, which is on victimbar.org. And all of this is free, by the way. We don't charge for any of this. The victimbar.org, we can connect somebody to an attorney. I review each and every one of those cases. They might not be referred. If they're not referred, we still try to give good resources, and they wouldn't be referred for those reasons we talked about. And then we have victimconnect.org, which is our hotline for victims to help them through the criminal justice process as well.
I mean, absolutely fantastic. We have a few minutes left. I want to talk real quick. The helpline that the organization have is a free helpline. Is that correct?
They're all free, yes.
And what is that number, if you will?
It is victimconnect.org for the help through the criminal process. And the way to get an attorney is on victimbar.org.
All right.
And Renee, those are confidential. If somebody calls there, right?
Yes.
That's all confidential and
100% confidential. And as far as the attorney referrals, I'm the only person that reviews them and sends them if they're appropriate for referral.
Awesome. So one of the things that I, in my research, I ran across, thanks to Jeff, Parallel Justice, the podcast that you do that is a heavyweight podcast. The cases you talk about, and I wrote some of them down, you know, his name was Ron Goldman, The Pursuit of Justice Against Jeffrey Epstein, How One Attorney Took on the Catholic Church, and Unmasking Our Idols. Man, you cover the gamut there. Those are some heavyweight podcasts. And by the way, Jeff Fritz here, you know, he sent the link over. I'll be checking them out. You can put that in the bank. But you know, tell us about them. We have a couple minutes left, but they're fantastic.
So as you mentioned, there's some heavy cases, and they're really cases that changed how we viewed the justice system in America. And the cool thing about them is we have so many fantastic attorneys in the Bar Association that every single case isn't discussed by some talking head pundit. It's discussed by the folks that lived it. So his name was Ron, on Ron Goldman. We talked to Kim and Fred Goldman, who were right there in it. For the Unmasking Our Idols, we talked to Vince Finaldi, who represented the victims against Michael Jackson.
Yeah.
We talked to Kristen Fedden Gibbons, who was the prosecutor in the Bill Cosby case. Mitch Garabedian, who was portrayed by Stanley Tucci in the movie Spotlight, he sat down with us to talk about the Catholic Church case. So these are attorneys or other individuals who were there. Yeah. They were making the decisions. They were the ones that brought the cases to light. But we're doing it so that victims are aware of some of the extra rights to them.
Yeah.
And we're also still trying to rip off some of that veil of secrecy. So as much as we can get this in the public eye, and as much as people know about what Boy Scouts are doing and how Boy Scouts have secret files and the Catholic Church has secret files, the more people know about that, the more they can be aware. And the more we start to break down those barriers to protecting our kids.
And also, it gives courage to people who would otherwise often be afraid to step forward. It's like the Me Too movement, which is a whole another show. I had the opportunity to bring on the heads of National SAG-AFTRA and the individuals that stepped forward and until you know, resources like this and awareness like this show and the things that you do on your podcast you know, came to the forefront, people were just terrified to even say anything, and they stayed victims at the highest level for their entire lives. And so this has been the fastest hour in radio, I will say. We're coming to an end. I want to thank, obviously, John Cervantes for making this happen, and congratulations on your first show. This is a home run. Jeff Fritz for putting this together. Now thank I understand you, why you wanted to do
first
it.
First show, but I've been on the radio how many times now?
Yeah, well it's, so Jeff and I have done, John and I have done, you know, dozens of shows together. I will say this, I've never heard him so laid back and just chilling and listening to what's going on. But I see why what you put together here, and it's a beautiful thing. And, of course, we want to thank Renee Williams, the executive director of the National Center for Victims of Crime, for everything that you do. The podcast, where can people listen to the podcast?
Anywhere you can find your podcasts. We're on Apple Podcasts. We are, our original platform is Captivate, but anywhere you can get your podcast, we are available.
All right. I want to thank our listeners for tuning in to Soul of Cervantes show here on WWDB Talk 860. I want to thank Jeff Fritz, of course, John Cervantes, and Renee Williams for being a fantastic panel. And of course, our listeners for tuning in. On behalf of everybody on the panel, I'm Joe Dougherty. Thanks for tuning in.